Let's open with prayer. Jesus, we welcome your presence into this room. Not that you were here and then we arrived, but we brought you with us when we came today. You dwell in us, and so when we gather, there is a unique atmosphere where you are working in ways that you choose not to work when it's just us. There's something about the corporate nature of what we do that you love. And that's why you said when two or three are gathered together in my name, I will be there with you. We thank you for that promise. Lord, give us insight today that comes from you. Enable us to see not only our perspective, but your perspective as you reveal that to us today in the category of decision making. Thank you for what you're going to do. We have confidence in your ability to guide us today in your name. And because of you, we are able to pray. Amen. All right, here's what I need you to do. I need you to get into six different groups, okay? So it doesn't matter how big they are. You can determine that, but I only have six pieces of paper to hand out. So six groups, and we're going to do a little decision-making exercise here this morning. And if you haven't been here for a couple weeks, no problem. This isn't limited to that. Okay, I'm seeing one here, two, three, four, five. We've got a big group. April and Paul, would you bump over here and join them? And then if you two would be part of this group, that would work great. Okay. All right, there's your question. There's your question. There's your question. Okay, well, you guys can break off and be your own group, and there's your question. Or you can do two, whatever. No rules. Okay, one quick word here before you get into it is we're looking at not what is your decision. That's not what we're after. We're looking at process. Want to talk about what would be your process that you would feel would be the appropriate way to arrive at a decision. I could care less what your decision is. I just want to know about your process. Okay, so go. Okay, try to wrap up in the next 2 minutes. Okay, it's time to report. Bill Hench, would your group go first? Read yours loud enough for everybody to hear. And then what was the process? That's what we're interested in. Okay.
We heard the thought process of, okay, there's not a human being beaten up or anything at this point. It's a piece of equipment that is in danger. So there's not necessarily the need to jump between them and the piece of equipment and endanger yourself. Different if there's four teenagers beating on another kid, then you might put yourself into that kind of position possibly.
Okay. Okay.
And then make yourself visibly apparent to the people, to the kids, so maybe that would be enough to scare them off.
Okay. So what I heard was you would pray, you would do a little bit of reasoning, and then you would commit to some kind of action. You're not just going to turn and walk away. You probably would do something. Input, anybody? Good, bad, thumbs up, thumbs down? How do you feel about their process? All right. Keith, how about your group? Thank you. Good job.
I have.
Oh, Sherry.
Keith read it very well. I mean, you expect him to have done so, but somehow it landed in my hands. You're a key member of your church's worship team. That applies to both of us. You're given the opportunity to accept a new position at a company in your area that will provide you with a significant pay increase and improved health care coverage. The downside is that it will require you to work on Sundays at least 2 times a month. Do you accept the position or not?
Okay, what'd you guys come up with? Process.
One, pray. You said ask others for input, which is spiritual. Seeing how it would affect your family dynamics, how are they affected, your children, your wife, your neighbors. And an example was, and then the question to ask is God testing me in this?
Okay. So I'm hearing you say you would pray and you would evaluate impact of your decision, and you would ask other people for input. Okay, thoughts? I'm getting a thumbs up, so I think that passes. Okay, good, we're on a roll. Who's the spokesperson? Paul, go for it. Where is Joe Cirillo when you need him?
Get a dark one evening and notice that your yard is now officially an eyesore. When you get to your front door, you see that your next door neighbor has taped a not so subtle note to it that pretty directly tells you to cut your bleeping grass ASAP. That is what he wrote.
Yeah, he's not editorializing. I wrote that.
What process would you use to determine how you will respond?
Okay. All right, I'm going to trust that you really did say that and that you're not just copying off of them. I trust you. I trust you.
Some of the other things people said was that go speak with the neighbor and be humble and maybe a little contrite. And we also talked about sharing our own heart in the sense that, like, in the Netflix story here, we actually do care about our yard, too.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That we would just be humble and explain the circumstances about why the yard is a state. And we all kind of agreed that we thought the neighbor may end up just saying, use my lawnmower.
All right.
We all seem to agree that neighbors tend to be neighborly when they actually seek understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Good. Input?
I'd say that the next time his lawn is overgrown, you go mow it and you get it out.
Yeah, yeah. I think the fact that you decided that your process would not involve taping a note to his door is probably a good process, too, that it was good to go talk to him face-to-face after praying. Good, okay. Let's go to the corner. Who's the spokesperson for the good-looking people sitting back there? Yeah, please do.
You're a professional painter with a solid reputation in your region for doing quality work at a fair price. You get a call from a contractor who offers to make you his go-to guy to paint a series of apartment buildings he is constructing in your area. The only catch is that he wants to pay you under the table to avoid offering the job publicly. Do you agree to do business with him? How would you go about deciding?
Okay. What'd you come up with? Okay.
Ask questions and find out what the situation is. Following that, going to prayer, looking to scripture to see what God tells us about, because under the table means it looks like, at least according to this scenario, he's trying to skirt some type of regulation, government regulation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
What does God tell us about obeying
right.
our laws? What are the consequences of that? And then also, you know, you need to consider, you know, without a contract, what about protection for myself, my family? You consider, what does this, you know, doing business with someone like that? Obviously, the other question is, what kind of reputation does this person have? Are there people we can talk to that would know this person? And then the other thing would be just, you know, what type of witness would this look like if we would engage in a, you know, what would probably be fairly lucrative, but yet at the same time,
right.
Would appear to conflict with what God's telling us.
Uh-huh. Wow. You did all that in like 7 minutes. That's impressive. So what I'm hearing you say is, and it's interesting to me that the first thing you didn't say, not even yielding to peer pressure, was pray. Because it was a little more black and white. It was a little more cut and dry. This is wrong. So I don't need to pray to evaluate whether to do something wrong or not. So you guys, you passed that test. But that you didn't just write him off. You said, I'm still going to go and have a conversation with him. I thought that was interesting. So, Daniel.
I actually heard something that seems really black and white about it, but are there actually regulations that he's trying to get around? Or is this just like he sees you as a convenient situation and maybe there's not a legal, maybe there's not a law that he's trying to get around?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's not actually a problem, but that it takes care in asking questions and knowing, like.
Not assuming.
Right, not assuming.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. I didn't know any of that when I wrote that. So, all right. So far, and there's other groups to go, best looking and most thoughtful answer. Yeah, good job. So, see, yeah. Wait a week to yours? All right. Well, you guys are next. Interesting. I wouldn't, but go ahead. There you go. There you go. Thank you.
Praying, and then we thought probably a conversation with this individual was important to get a sense of, you know, him wanting to appreciate through the car versus is there any other way that he could show appreciation? You know, would he be open to that type of thing? Because we also talked about the perception that could come with the car. Obviously, we don't know from what's written about the wealth of the area or the wealth of the church. Is this going to be a challenge for the pastor having the flashy car? But we also did talk about in prayer, if you feel like God is affirming, not as big of a struggle.
Mm-hmm. The tricky part of that question was there really isn't a moral absolute right or wrong, that it's always wrong to accept it or it's always the right thing to do to decline it. There really isn't that clear cut that maybe there would be in a moral situation with our painting contractor. The alternative thought process after praying of, is there a way that he could show appreciation by gifting the church with something which would still benefit the pastor? I mean, he would be blessed by that, is one option. I'm sure there are other options, but the process is what we were after, and I think you nailed it. I think you nailed it. Input? Paul?
There's a current thing probably in the last couple of months where there's a website where this person's actually been, it sounds really goofy, but they've been taking pictures of mega churches, pastors, their shoes.
Yes.
And pointing out that, why is this guy wearing $5,000 shoes?
Right, that's where this came from.
Circumstances where right. This guy was probably gifted or whatever.
Right.
But I was thinking right here, and I was like, I would just say, thank you, that's very kind, but one, just because of the nature of your job, like, it's like you said about, like, what's it going to look like to the church that you're driving around a $75,000 car and you're the pastor?
But, just to give you the flip side, well, but let me give you the flip side. Some pastors buy cheap suits so that they don't give off the idea that they have a lot of money and that they're better than their congregation. Some pastors buy cheap suits, and then the people who visit their church go, I don't want to sit under the teaching of a guy who buys cheap suits when I buy $5,000 suits. And depending on the context that you're in, what's that? Yeah, depending on the context that you're in, it can make a difference. All right, I've lost you. I buy cheap shoes, except for my walking shoes. My walking shoes are more expensive than I even care to share, but if I don't use them, my feet hurt. So, Sherry. Cares. It's a $75,000 Lexus. Oh. I could get used to it. I could overcome it. Any other thoughts on any of these processes that we... Oh, you've got another one. That's right. I gave your group two because you were enormous.
It's 10 p.m. on a Saturday night, and we just completed an exhausting day that included a breakfast meeting with a committee from church, taking your children to two soccer games, sharing lunch with a woman you're mentoring, and buying supplies for an event your DNA group is having the next day. You've just collapsed onto the couch with the remote in one hand and a slice of pizza in the other when your phone rings. It's a person from your church who's going through a stressful situation with their job. Ask if they can talk to you for a few minutes, but you know it will likely be an hour. How do you decide what to say to them? One of the first things, we only have a minute and a half to go over this one, but
okay.
One of the first things that we said is probably, this is a very quick situation.
I was going to say, that's the trick part of this one is you can't consult a friend and you barely have time to pray because you're on the phone. So,
That probably the approach and the tone and what you've been doing, how you've been communicating to this person up to this point, is probably largely going to guide. But almost the wisdom in acting in this situation is dependent on the wisdom that you've been acting in previous situations.
Mm-hmm.
Later, trying to balance, obviously the considerations are balancing, you know, your energy and your ability to have that conversation with caring for another person.
Right.
I think probably just trying to make an assessment of yourself, like, are you mm-hmm. going to be short? Are you going to actually be able to pay attention? Are you going to...
Right. The biggest temptation for me in that situation is that it's uncaring if I don't give that person time. A realistic, more unselfish perspective is, won't they get a better version of me if I agree to call them tomorrow or meet with them tomorrow? But the pressure is enormous to never say no when someone says, hey, I need to talk to you. And if you yield to that constantly, it can have repercussions, but it's very real. And it's very difficult to make a godly decision in that environment because... we're trained to serve. We're all trained to be servants. And so where does the line come? Again, no right or wrong answer, but the process, which I think is really good, is what has been your process up to this point? Because that's really going to determine what ultimately decision you make. You may know something about the situation that this person is always saying, I need you right now, and maybe they typically don't. So maybe you can take some comfort in that and put them off until you're in a better place. So, Chris? I think so.
I think probably even your relationship with the person so far might give you like a sense of that. But,
right. Yeah. I know my problem is, with me, it's always urgent. You know, the retired basketball player Bill Walton said, minor surgery is surgery that's done on someone else. You know, when it's me, it is always urgent. And so my response typically is, I need you right now, because I sense that it's very important. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes it can wait. So, good. All right, great job. The point of the exercise is, other than to emphasize process, is to simply say that sometimes there isn't a clear-cut, right or wrong, up or down decision to be made. And so sometimes we make bad decisions. We are not above making bad decisions. And we need to kind of come back and touch base with that, that even with a class on making better decisions, there are going to be times when we make decisions that we regret and we look back and say, oops, probably shouldn't have done that. Shouldn't have accepted the car. Shouldn't have shot a flaming arrow at my neighbor's house in retaliation for the note he left on my door. There are times when we go, probably shouldn't have done that. We're going to have those times. But if we stop and pray, and if we have a person that we can go to that we can say, I'm thinking about sending this email, what do you think? Let me show it to you, what do you think? I think we can save ourselves some trouble if we go that direction. All right, we're starting a new category. Paul.
Let's just say, right? Like when you say about stopping and praying,
mm-hmm.
For me, I think of that, I think sometimes we think we're stopping and praying for God's wisdom. especially like this last one, I think it's, for me, it's more about stopping and praying for God to check my attitude.
Mm-hmm.
What's my attitude right now?
Mm-hmm.
Am I in a place to deal with this? If I go to my neighbor's door, am I in a place
right.
to be humble, or am I going to go, you know, you're a believing fool or whatever? You know, am I going to lose my cool? Or if you're going to pick up that phone, are you not going to be able to put up with it? You have an opinion that the person's full of shenanigans. And you're like, is that going to come out? It's like, so
yeah.
I mean, wisdom matters, but I think a lot of times these things, you need to just slow down and say, do I have the right attitude?
What's the other benefit of stopping and praying? When we don't respond immediately, but we stop and pray, even if it's for 10 seconds, what's one of the hidden benefits of doing that? Yeah, we calm down. We calm down. We breathe a little easier. Doesn't change the decision, perhaps, but I know there have been times when if I would have taken 10 seconds and calmed down before I reacted, I would have been better. I think you add to that that sometimes God does, even in that moment, give us direction. God, I don't have a lot of time to talk about this. I need to make a decision now. What should I do? I think there are times when God responds to that and does give us the help that we need. But I also think that Paul's absolutely right, is that it's just a good process. And that's why the Bible says pray without ceasing. It doesn't have to be in the middle of your workday, at your cubicle, get down on your hands and knees and pray. It can be, Lord, help. And I think God responds to those prayers. At least that's been my experience. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
So we do get those surprise things. They just come out of the blue, and we need to have a response rather quickly. But a lot of times, if we have been processing life more correctly and have been having the gospel put on our life in all areas, these decisions are not quite as difficult.
If there's one thing that I'm learning, and we're talking in the worship service today about learning to live like Jesus, if there's one thing that I'm learning, is the more time that I put between the event and my reaction to the event, the higher quality decision I make. And sometimes you don't have that time, and we're talking about some of those situations, but if I cannot react in the moment and put a day or 2 days, I find that I usually am apologizing less for the decisions that I make, rather than the, well, yeah. And that goes for marriage too, doesn't it? All right, we're starting a new section today of our study, and it's faith, which is, I believe, the key ingredient for better decision making. You're busy. Your pace is hurried. You make decisions through the course of the day, some small, some tactical, some significant, some more insignificant. You have plans and you need to execute those plans. Others have expectations of your time. They have expectations for your work. Your pace is hurried. The question is, what is the quality of your decision making when you live like that? Part of the decision-making process that we've just talked about is if we are at a pace where we have to respond immediately, or we do choose to respond immediately all the time, and we don't take a deep breath, and we don't whisper a prayer, and we don't consult with someone, the quality of decision-making goes way down. How do we get it right? The key ingredient, I believe, is the ingredient of faith. Do you remember this story? It's from 1 Kings chapter 19, and I'll just read a couple verses. The Lord said, "Go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by." Then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice said to him, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" God speaks to us when we pray. We believe that. We've experienced that. But often he speaks to us in a tone that can be missed. And the pace of our lives is not conducive to hearing the voice of God. The way we choose to live, which is controllable by us, often causes us to miss the voice of God. Get this, and here's the trap door, and I didn't set you up for it, but you played along perfectly, even when we're praying. Even when we're praying, because there are times when the only prayer, like Daniel on the phone, is, "Lord, help me, because I don't have time to call somebody else. I don't have time to set 15 minutes aside to pray. I got this person on the phone. I need to respond." There are going to be times like that. But often, because of the way we live our lives, we put ourselves in situations where we react as if every decision needs to be made right away. Let me give you a quick illustration of that. There once was a time when a communication method was invented called email. Now, this is way before any of you, so you, if you don't know anything about email, don't worry about it. But there used to be a time when you would sit at your desk with your, I was going to say laptop, but this is even predating laptop. You would sit in front of your console, and you would get an email. And the expectation that came with that email was that within a day or two, you would get back to the person who had just emailed you. That was standard acceptable. If I hear from you in 2 or 3 days, I sent this email. Because email was doing what? It was replacing snail mail. And no one would walk to the post office and put a letter in the mailbox, sending it to someone, and go home and sit and wait impatiently for a response. Because you knew that it was going to take at least a day, maybe 2 days, maybe a month, to be able to get that letter into the hands of the person who was sending it. So there was no expectation that an email was going to be responded to quickly. Guess what? Keith knows. How many emails come across your desk in a day? I don't want to know. My average is 30. I deal with about 30 emails a day. Somewhere along the line, the expectation changed. And now, I have placed on myself, or culture has placed on me, an expectation that before the day is over, I'm going to have responded to all of those emails. And I didn't get that concept on my own. I was at a leadership conference where a CEO of a major corporation was talking about this, and he said, "This is now the expectation. We sit at our computers and an email comes in, and we feel the need to turn it around right away. We need to respond right away. We need to have an answer right away." What used to be instant messaging is now email. We've come to play by the same rules. Now, we just got done talking about the fact that when we respond too quickly, usually the quality of decision goes down. But when the pressure is on to respond quickly, it doesn't help. Now, I instituted this policy myself more than a decade ago, and I don't always stick to it. There are times when I violate it, but for the most part, when the sun goes down on Friday night, I don't deal with email until Sunday night or Monday morning. And I try to tell people, if you need me, call me, but if it's an email, I probably won't look at it Saturday or Sunday. I just decided that I was going to build in a buffer where I'm not going to respond to those. It has nothing to do with taking a deep breath before responding. It's just about a bigger cushion. But you know what the biggest issue was for me in trying to do that? Faith. I had to have confidence that God was going to keep the universe running and keep the church running and minister to people while I checked out from doing email for 48 hours. I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to buy into the, I've got to be sitting by the phone constantly. Now, I used to be able to leave work at the church, and I know I've got this long commute. You should pity me because it's really bad. But I used to be able to finish up at the church, and I would go home, and that was the end of it. And then they invented the laptop. And now, everything that I do in the office, for the most part, on my laptop, I can take home and do. So I've had to learn to leave my laptop in the office, because when it's there, I'm tempted to use it. Building in a buffer. But you know what that means? I'm not able to be productive. I'm not able to get things done when I leave my laptop in the office. Faith. I've got to have a level of believing that when I'm not engaged in ministering to people, that God can still run the universe and he can still take care of all of you, even if I'm not here. We choose to live our lives with a pattern that makes it intrinsically difficult for us to hear God's voice because of the gentle whisper. There are still times when he flags me down with the loud bullhorn, and I hear that. But there are times when I don't put myself in the place of hearing his voice, and it's my fault. It's not his fault. And I'm not hearing from him, but it's not me that has moved. It's not God that's moved, it's me. We used to have this thing in college. Some of you can probably share this experience. Early in the semester, guys and girls, guy would be sitting behind the wheel of his car, and his girl would be right there with his arm around her driving. You'd see that. September, October in the semester, you'd see that. During the course of the semester, that space between the two of them would start accumulating empty McDonald's bags and Pizza Hut boxes and books and papers. And eventually you'd drive down and you'd see somebody driving, and he's here and she's over here. She has drifted away slowly without any decision being made, just casually. There's some distance between the two of them. When I live my life at a pace where I am putting on myself the need to be in control of everything, I don't allow myself to have those quiet moments where I get away and hear the voice of God. I have found it extremely difficult. Recently, I build into my schedule at least two times a year to do what I call planning days. And in the spring, I go away for a day and I spend the day planning what's going to be the sermons that you're going to hear the following year. About 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, I had a planning day scheduled and I had it X'd off in my calendar. And in the space of an hour, three people said, "I need you on this particular day. This has to happen today." And eventually I had to call the guy whose church I hang out in the basement of his church and say, "I won't be there today. I just can't." I tried to block it off, but the pressure is enormous to not live life that way. It is so much easier to not live life that way. And that's why when we are making those decisions that sometimes we put ourselves in position and we go, "Whatever happened to the voice of God? He didn't go anywhere. I drifted." So how do we put ourselves in a place where we can have confidence in God that will put us in a position where we can hear his voice and make better decisions? That's what we're going to talk about. The first step is this: making God the foundation. Not me, but God. Making God the foundation. When I make myself the foundation, I need to be on call 24/7. I need to have all the answers. I need to be there. I need to do that. When God's the foundation, sometimes he doesn't even need me. Now, question, class, because I've been talking now for a while. What is it that makes us slide over into being the foundation instead of God being the foundation? Why is that difficult for us to say God is the foundation, I don't need to be, because he is? What makes that hard, Bill?
I think sometimes he's not in a hurry and I am.
Bingo. Bingo. That's right. Yeah. Sometimes I drag my feet and pray about things because I know what the answer is and I don't want to do it. Yeah, I agree. I agree. Anybody else? Good answers. Why do we struggle with saying, God's foundational to this, my business, my family, my work, even my recreation, God is foundational, not me. Pat? Mm-hmm.
Probably already formulated what we want.
Mm-hmm.
So now we aren't open-minded when we go to prayer.
Right. And that's the trap door of saying, well, I prayed about it, because sometimes I pray about it, but I've already decided what I'm going to do. And so if I've already predetermined what I'm going to do and I go to prayer about it, the conclusion that I'm going to come to is going to look like me. See, there's no mystery to the fact that in the Old Testament, the idol-worshipping nations created idols that looked like them. The God that we often serve is a God who looks an awful lot like me, like us, who does things the way we would do them, who responds the way we would respond. So I'm very time-conscious, so I create a God who is very time-conscious. I like that God, yeah. And if you're not time-conscious, then you must be wrong, because the God that I've created in my mind is very time conscious. So he looks like me. You ever played this game? I say the word green, and then I say, look around the room. And Janelle stands out because she's got green on today. Now, you might not have been paying attention to Janelle, which is your own problem, but when I said green and you looked around the room, you picked up on that. Because I had planted something in your mind that wasn't there before, but now you're thinking green, and when you're thinking green, you see green. That's the way we make decisions. I'm thinking about me, because we have this human thing called selfishness. I'm thinking about me, so when I'm forced with a decision, my natural tendency in that decision-making process is going to be to see green, me. So how's this going to benefit me? So every decision that isn't prayed about properly begins with, how's this going to impact me? Is this going to be convenient for me? Am I going to have fun? Is this going to benefit me? Am I going to look good, or will I look foolish? Because be honest, sometimes the only reason we reject something is because it's not going to be fun, or it's going to cost me something, or I might be embarrassed learning to do something that I've never done before. No, I'm not going to do that. But when we learn God's ways and make him the foundation, we are opening the door for him to come up against what we've already determined, and we're giving him permission to take us away from our natural impulse. That is so difficult for me. I'm not going to speak for you. That is so difficult for me. Because I've crafted this God to look like me. My God is a Mets fan who has a quirky sense of humor and loves history. Amazing, isn't it? So, when somebody else isn't that way, my immediate response is, you need to be more like my God. You need to embrace my God. When Sherry's dad passed away, very unexpectedly, back in November of 1997, we went down to Virginia, and I actually preached at his funeral. If you knew Sherry's dad, he was the type of person that when the family was getting ready to go somewhere, he would be in the car with the car running in the driveway 10 minutes early, waiting. And if you weren't there 10 minutes early, you were considered late. And Sherry grew up that. And we have not fought through the years about being places on time, because we just said we're not going to live that way. We're not going to be uptight about time. We're going to leave when we feel like leaving, and we're going to try to be on time and everything. But it was his way, and in a season of his life, it almost became laughable. We started his funeral service 5 minutes early to honor him. It was his way. And we all knew that that was his tendency, that was his way. Making God the foundation means that we approach decision-making by saying, what would be the way of God in this situation? So let's come back to the lawn that isn't mowed and the mean note from the neighbor. What would be somebody be honest, what would be your natural way in dealing with that? And you don't have to have been in the group because you guys have, like the continents, you've drifted back into your own seats. What would be your natural way to deal with that neighbor?
Ignore it.
Ignore it? Anybody else?
Cut your grass and put all your clippings on his yard.
Dave? Lose your temper. Let him trigger your temper. What would be God's way? Right. Yep. Yeah. The ability to walk over to the neighbors and go, gosh, I'm sorry, you're right. It's an eyesore. And remember, you had already concluded that it was an eyesore when you pulled in the driveway. But what happens when the neighbor says it's an eyesore? It's not that bad. Because now I'm looking at it from my perspective, a godly perspective, and because of the indwelling Holy Spirit, enables me to love my enemy. And in that moment, if my neighbor feels like my enemy, part of loving him is not shooting a flaming arrow into the side of his house. You know, that's just the way it works. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So the connections were made, the outcome was awesome, people came through our doors, and
believe me, Ketha, this is coming from a guy who used to live and die on what Sunday attendance was. I used to, in my first church with 35 people, I prayed that the Lord would get us to 50. That was just going to be so glorious when we got to 50, and I would go pull the registry down at the end of the day and look at it and see how many were there. And it affected the rest of my day. From noon till I went to bed Sunday night was impacted by that number, which I had absolutely no control over. God had to teach me that his perspective was not how many, but value each person that's there. Each individual person is valuable. That's God's way. My way is bigger is better, right? You know, 20 is better than 10, 5 is better than 3. God doesn't always approach it that way. His way is different. So, great illustration. In my approach to issues, the key to a good decision is not to arrive at it based on what I think, but God, what is your perspective? And sometimes God reveals that his perspective is more is better. Like bringing lost people to him. He values lost people. So if it's bringing lost people to him, he does value that. But sometimes I think I miss the trees because I'm concentrating on the forest, and you're absolutely right. Love this quote. This is Walt's brother. How'd you like to be Walt Disney's brother? The lesser known Disney. They worked together for quite a while. It's not hard to make decisions when you know what your values are. When we say, God, I want your perspective on this matter, it makes decision-making a lot easier because instead of me running the show, now I've turned it over to him and I'm giving him the opportunity to speak into it. All right, we're almost out of time, but I want to just do these verses before we wrap up. Philippians 3:10, we won't look them up for time. Paul said, I want to know Christ. Yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in death. If we had more time, I would ask this question. How does participating in the sufferings of Christ make your decision-making better? You gain his perspective. I read a quote recently that I sent to someone, and they wrote back and said, that's a keeper. And it had something about, it's not that we are unwilling to make hard decisions, it's that we are unwilling to make unpopular decisions. And the person that I sent it to wrote back and said, that's a keeper. That's a good quote. I like that quote. It's not that we're unwilling to make hard decisions. We don't like to make unpopular decisions. If you make a decision and you get whacked, the tendency is to go, ooh, that was a bad decision. I shouldn't have done that. If you make a decision and it costs you money, our human tendency is to say, that was a bad decision. Shouldn't have done that. But sometimes in God's perspective, decisions that cause pain and suffering and death are not bad decisions at all. And then Romans 11:36, for from him and through him and for him are all things, to him be the glory forever. Amen. What is the aim of the decision? To bring glory to God. And God can be glorified with 250 people, and God can be glorified with 50 people. The number doesn't determine that. But I'm going to pick on Janelle because she's my friend. If Janelle walks around all yesterday while people are here eating, going, lousy, 50 people. We prepared for 250 people and we only have 50 people. What is wrong? We didn't advertise. Where's Bev? Bev didn't write it good enough for weekly update. What is wrong with Bev? Which is a question I ask from time to time. All of a sudden, the number doesn't matter anymore. The aim was to glorify God, and her attitude isn't glorifying God. And by the way, she didn't do any of that yesterday, I'm sure. Or if she did, she had the Christian decency to do it internally. Yeah, we've all been there. Often we lament the outcome instead of the process. And the process is, was God glorified in this? God wasn't glorified in the numbers. God was glorified in the heart and the reaction when it didn't go the way that perhaps it was expected to go. And then finally, this is a little bit longer, from Colossians chapter 1. The Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. For in him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities. All things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together, and he is the head of the body, the church. He is the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have the supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood shed on the cross. I leave you with this thought. It matters so little about me and you. It is all about him. And when we get the idea that our decision is monumental, we need to read Colossians 1 and understand that if God is foundational, then I am not foundational, and no one is indispensable. God can move any of us off the scene in a heartbeat and replace us with someone else. Someday, someone's going to sit behind your desk, and it won't be you. It's inevitable. You're sitting behind a desk that somebody else used to sit behind. That is God's way. He doesn't rely upon any one individual. And as great an evangelist as Billy Graham was, he's not with us anymore. Anybody panicked? Not if God's foundational. But if I'm foundational or if you're foundational, then we go, oh, what are we going to do? We don't have that person anymore. God's foundational. And that makes the decision-making less potent. I don't need to stress about it so much. Because if that's my aim, God's not moved. He's foundational. All right, we'll pick up there next week. We are on the home stretch. Thank you for your good participation today.